You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Baritone Nathan Gunn is backstage at Lyric.
Rossini for me is, I think it's such happy music, you know, especially Barbara Sinnott. But it's also challenging. I mean, when you first, the first time you learn it, you have so many notes, you know, and you're trying to figure out why is all this, why is that in there?
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. In this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with baritone Nathan Gunn, who's starring at Lyric in the title role of Figaro, the Barber of Seville. Nathan's one of the most exciting American artists before the public. He made a spectacular Lyric debut in Billy Budd. He's been back twice since then and will be with us again next season. He's having a terrific international career in opera houses and concert halls all over the world. Before we play the interview, here's a brief synopsis of The Barber of Seville. Count Almaviva is in love with Rosina, the ward of old Dr. Bartolo. Bartolo wants to marry Rosina himself and keeps her under lock and key. With the help of the wily barber Figaro, Almaviva makes his intentions known to Rosina, identifying himself as the lovelorn Lindoro. Bartolo persuades Rosina that Lindoro plans to betray her by delivering her into the clutches of a certain Count Almaviva. When Almaviva and Figaro arrive at night to abduct Rosina, she rejects Almaviva, but her fury turns to joy when the Count reveals that he and Lindoro are one and the same. He hastily marries Rosina, and when officers summoned by Bartolo arrive to arrest him, he pulls rank, leaving Bartolo frustrated but resigned to the situation. Now, on to the interview with Nathan Gunn. I hope you enjoy it. So I'm here with Nathan Gunn, who is singing the title role in our Barber of Seville production, and you've just come from what we call a stage orchestra rehearsal. What does that involve exactly?
Well, we have two of these here for this particular show. So we ran through the first act, went over a couple of scenes once or twice, sometimes three times, and basically what it does is when it's called the stage orchestra, usually the director is involved and in charge of all the stage rehearsals. But when it's a stage orchestra rehearsal, it means the conductor is in charge. So it's his rehearsal. We do all the staging. I was in costume. John Osborne was in costume just because part of the directing involves some complicated, clothing changes. So basically what we do is try to solidify all of our musical choices and make it as seamless as possible.
Now, when you sang Figaro, I think your first one was in St. Louis.
Yeah, very first time.
Now that was
in English.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because this is a role where you have to move pretty quickly through text and fairly straightforward in Italian. But what was it like singing your first one in English? Did it help you?
Yeah, I'd say so. I thought it was a good introduction to the part because this. I was thinking to myself before the very first scene that I'm in this first act. I was walking out there. I was talking to my dresser, and I said, "I wonder how many times this opera has been performed since it was created." A million, hundreds of thousands, I don't know. But with that comes a huge amount of tradition. And sometimes that you get locked into that tradition. And rather than trying to put your own stamp on it, you try to just do it as it should be done. And that's kind of boring, to tell you the truth. So having performed Figaro the first time in English with a different translation, and which is, English being my native tongue, it let me sort of think about the character in a slightly different way. So I think it was actually a positive way of beginning this role.
And you subsequently did it in Vancouver and San Francisco.
And San Francisco, and recorded it with, Sony Records?
Right.
And
I was going to ask you about that, but what's important about San Francisco, one of the many reasons, is that you did it with your current tenor, John Osborne.
John Osborne, right.
Yes. Now, I've watched you twice now in the big first act duet, and it seems to me that you have a fantastic rapport. I mean, how important is teamwork in Barber of Seville?
Tremendously important. I mean, it's all about, well, if you think about the story, and I think Dr. Bartolo says this, he feels like everybody is in collusion against him. And in a way it is. Not only musically, it has to really work. We have to work as a team, whether it's a duet or a trio or a big ensemble, all sort of against Bartolo, who never really gets to participate in any of these. You know, he may be in a duet or a trio, but he's always sort of separate. He's always jabbering along about something and is trying to fight the tide, the current. And so I would say probably the only other opera that I do where I think the ensembles are more important, or probably only other composer would be Mozart, to tell you the truth. But here it's got to be tight, and you have to have a connection with the person you're singing with in order to really make it work.
And you also have another big duet that you do with Rosina, who in our production is Joyce DiDonato.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
She did a podcast also, and she spent several minutes talking about what a treat it is to work with you.
Yeah, it's been a while. We haven't sung together for quite some time.
You did Così fan tutte together, right?
That's right.
Now, I imagine that you must feel the same way about working with her. What do you most enjoy about that relationship on the stage, rehearsing and performing with Joyce?
Well, Joyce is great to work with. I mean, in any music, but in Rossini particularly, because a lot of people, because it's so difficult, especially vocally difficult, that particular part for her, well, for everybody really, but for Rosina, a lot of colleagues that I've sung with her, they spend a lot of time thinking about it when they're on stage, you know? Their mind's focused on that. But she is such an expert at this music that it allows her to engage in the story. So we have a real connection when we're talking to each other, and you can make subtle differences and changes from, what you might have planned on doing. I'm not saying changing the blocking or anything, but just the tenor of the relationship. It could be, Figaro and Rosina, no one really knows. Is he always flirting with her? What's he doing in their house? I mean, why is it that this man is allowed in with her and Bartolo seems to think it's okay, Because he doesn't want to be around any other men. But for some reason, he lets Figaro in there. So what is this relationship that they have?
So you can play to all of that.
You can play. Sometimes it can be very brother-sistery. Sometimes it can be a little bit more, flirtatious. And it depends on where we go. Or one person sort of takes it in that direction. And she does that. It's easy to, work off her.
Now, you start off with the most famous lyric baritone aria I can think of. And is it... is Figaro's aria one that you've known ever since you started to sing? Or?
No, I shied away from that for a little while because Rossini for me is, I think it's such happy music, especially Barber of Seville. But it's also challenging. I mean, when you the first time you learn it, you have so many notes, and you're trying to figure out why is all this, why is that in there? And so it wasn't a natural fit in the beginning. I would tend more towards art song and, that kind of, and Mozart. But I was in the Met program and I had sung a recital with some of John Musto's music on it. And Renato Scotto was coaching at the time, all of us as a young artist. So I had a coaching with her the next day. And she's like, oh, I love your recitals, very good. You seem to love that music. But why don't you sing any Rossini or Bellini? I mean, do you really like the new, like this? And I'm like, well, I said, well, I don't know, Figaro. I'm working on these other things, and it's a pretty tough aria, so I'm planning on coming to that eventually. And she's like, well, you could always be a postman. You could be a postman. I need some mailmen out there. It's okay, but no. So it made me think, well, maybe I should start looking at this particular role. And it's fun. And what I thought at the beginning, it's hard enough to... communicate something. What kind of man is he? How do you communicate what kind of character you're setting up at the beginning? Your own, not just what everybody else has done, but your own character. But nowadays, I mean, you can't just stand there and sing it. You have to,
Now the singing.
You have to do all this other stuff, which is much more difficult.
I was going to ask you about that. But the singing of the aria in this production is the most physically active that I've seen, I think.
Yeah, that's a tough
what
one.
What is going on the stage?
Well, the aria begins, rather than having him outside of his shop, he's in his shop and he's waking up. So he starts off on the second floor in sort of a loft in his little shop where he's sleeping, asleep. And he's waking up, and he gets up, and he's in his boxer shorts and nightshirt, and he has to get ready for work. So he's, you know, empties his bedpan and throws the mattress out the window while putting on tights and the knickers and the other shirt and, you know, sliding down poles and then shaving, and he fixes up a wig. And this, all of this is going on while singing the aria.
Shaving while you're singing the aria.
Yeah, there's one. Yeah, I try to just shave my chin because I don't have enough time to actually do the real job.
With foam or with?
Oh, yeah, it's with the foam and the straight edge razor. And some kids show up at one point and I have to shoo them away and clean up a wig, and it's incredibly involved.
unless the music is totally second nature.
Oh yeah, it has to be second nature. Yeah.
Now, do you spend a fair amount of time in the rest of the opera being as active as that?
It's not as active as the very beginning. There's some productions, yes. The production in San Francisco, I was running all over the place.
In the aria.
Oh, well, in the beginning, the aria at the beginning, this is for the entire opera. The aria at the beginning took place I was on a Vespa, and I'm riding around this two-story house with a woman on the back who's dressed like a man, and the whole job was to, during the aria, change her from this man into a woman. And it was completely nuts. So I had very specific cues, da 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 da, womp, womp, stop on this, you know, moped and start singing, you know. It was crazy. It was nuts. About as busy as this one, I'd say.
But that is amazing. But on a motorcycle.
Yeah, on a motorcycle.
That is
incredible. People love it, and it really, we can do it nowadays. You know, singers can, we're up for the job, you know. And
Is Figaro a character that you feel particularly positively about? I mean, if he were a friend of yours, would you go to him with a problem? I mean, the way all of Seville seems to do. I mean, how do you feel about?
He's a bit. I don't know if Figaro can actually put anything in the vault. You know what I mean? I think if you tell him something, it might just be. I think, like, the idea in the aria, and he is that people come to him with their problems, want to tell them a secret, but they don't really want the secret. They give it to him so that everybody will know about it. You know, he's not shy. He is
not particularly discreet. Well, he has to be fairly discreet because he's dealing
discreet.
With Rosina.
Well,
and...
But he's more like he is dealing with. Well, you know, the Count is a different story because he could actually ruin his life. But everybody else, you know, they come to him to kind of pass along an idea to make something happen. He's sort of the modern day what I always think of him as kind of like a car salesman or somebody who brings people together, you know, and incredibly positive. Yeah, I think he would be a friend. I mean, incredibly positive and ambitious, a self-made man, does what he has to do to get by, and has no malice at all towards anybody. He finds life and people amusing.
I should think of all of your repertoire. This would be a great role for your kids to see you in.
Yeah,
have they seen you in it?
No, though three of them are coming
to Chicago
for the dress rehearsal to watch it, and three of my sister's children too.
Well, I hope they saw at least a picture of you on the Vespa because that's really amazing.
Yeah. they love that.
Does this piece? I mean, you talked about what Scotto said to you about, mm-hmm. you know, learning Bellini, Rossini, etc. Yeah. Does this piece make you want to explore bel canto repertoire any further, or just happy with this one Rossini role?
Malatesta is one role I've wanted.
Malatesta and Don Pasquale.
Don Pasquale is one that I would like to look at. But I don't. There's a funny thing about bel canto is that I see Donizetti and Rossini as being completely different. I don't. For me, they seem to be in very different styles of music, and Rossini being, in my judgment, a little more substantial, or at least it's as good as it, for what it is, is as good as it gets. You know what I mean? He couldn't have. He's not. Yeah, I don't particularly like Rossini's more serious operas, but when it comes to comedy and what he's trying to express, it's perfect. It's just genius stuff. Donizetti, sometimes Bellini, sometimes. I mean, it's maybe as good as Rodgers and Hammerstein. You know what I mean? It's just, but it's opera,
which is pretty good.
Which is really, really, really good. You know. So I've put thought into it, but there are so many other opera. I mean, I do a lot of new pieces because I think it's important to do that. And obviously, as you know, a lot of Britain and a lot of Mozart, and, you know, to fit in some bel canto, you know.
Not a huge priority.
Not a huge priority, no.
You made a recording of the role, you were saying, for Sony. Was that a little nerve-wracking? Because it was a live performance that was going on to the CD.
Well, yeah, and it was also, that particular recording was, I think the original conductor had a heart attack and died. It was, there was a lot of...
Last-minute stuff.
Last-minute stuff and a last-minute Rosina, he wanted it to be very like it's written, and so I leaned away from a lot of the traditional things, flourishes and whatnot, which was kind of interesting for me. I found that interesting. It was also on Victory in Europe Day when we when we did the performance. I was in Munich on VE Day, and that was a little bit weird considering most of the performers were Americans, and you know.
Did you get a chance to do any retakes, or on the CD exactly what people heard?
It was mostly what went on the CD, but I think, if I'm remembering correctly, we did two performances, and then we did another day of you know, just going through certain things, doing different cuts to add in case there was some mistake. And I know that during maybe it was just one performance, during the performance at the beginning, the whole beginning of the Largo, Figaro's aria, the microphone wasn't turned on, so we had to redo that all over again at, you know, 10 a.m. in the morning the next day. And, you know, it was a lot of days of singing in a row. So by the end of it, we were all pretty exhausted.
You've made another recording that we need to talk about, which is your second solo disc, and both of your CDs, your solo discs, are of American repertoire. What's the difference between the two discs?
Well, the first disc was a debut disc with EMI Records, and it was it's called American Anthem, and it's with piano, and done almost entirely as an acoustical recording. Just we found a nice acoustic, recorded it in there over a couple days. This other one, what I wanted to do was, one, do American songs again, but things that kind of, it ended up being by composers that sometimes write classical music and composers that sometimes write musical theater. Mostly what I wanted were songs that were beautiful with really good text, and I wanted it recorded in a way so that it wouldn't be odd to the ears of people listening today, because most people, they listen in their cars, or they listen while they're cooking dinner, or they're doing, you know, they receive, it's so easy to turn on your iPod, stick it in the, you know, in the iPod player thing and listen to whatever you have on there while you're cooking or in your car or whatever. And I really wanted to, I see recording as another venue, kind of like a recital hall is a venue or an opera stage is a venue. And I wanted to find things that I could, were best suited for that kind of recording situation. And I think I did. And we had a small kind of intimate recording. Most of the songs ended up being primarily love songs, not all of them, and had a very eclectic group of writers. I mean, everybody from, you know, Ben Moore or Gene Shearer, who's, you know, Gene obviously, you know, writes librettos, to, you know, people like Joe Thalkin, who writes primarily musical theater, John Bacchino, who's a musical theater writer. I had one Billy Joel song, two Tom Waits songs, a Sting song, and it's funny because those are the ones that most people think are, especially the Sting song, are written by classical composers. It's the most challenging harmonically than a lot of the other ones.
I wonder if you're the only Figaro around who can also sing the Tom Waits and Billy Joel repertoire.
Well, it's exciting to me to be able to. I have lots of composers sending me things all the time, to be able to perform some of these songs, because I always tell people, you know, the ones who were singing Rossini when he wrote this were contemporary singers, and I think it's up to us to be able to say, look, it's not that different. You can sing Rossini on the opera stage, or you can sing this Tom Waits song in a recital or on a disc, and if it's quality, it's quality, you know.
I actually wanted to see if you had had any experiences of talking to your operatic colleagues, your American operatic colleagues, about spending more time, paying more attention to music of their own country. Have you gone through a lot of that sort of thing?
I've talked to some about it. Some are very against it. some really kind of like just old school opera. I really think, and you know, that's fine. For me though, artistically and personally, I want to be engaged and involved in what's happening today. And I really think that we love to categorize things. We like to say bel canto, we like to, you know, the Mozart classical style and the romantic and all this stuff, but really it's singing, you know, it's sustained talking. And if you have a good text and you have good orchestration and you have something beautiful that speaks, I feel like as an artist and a singer should be able to give something to that, and that's our job, is to communicate that way.
Now, when it comes to classical singers in this country, I think we have a more distinguished line of baritones than in any other vocal category, and you are clearly part of that line. So have you been especially inspired by any of your American predecessors?
Well, you know, the one that I listened to and admired and just think, wow, talk about breaking down boundaries. He started as a vaudeville singer and ended up being one of America's most famous, even though, you know, it's kind of pre-recording, so you don't hear many recordings of him, is John Charles Thomas. You know, he could do anything. He would go out, he would sing at the Met.
Traviata
or something like that, and then he'd be on his, you know, singing one of his 75 concerts during, you know, the year, and he'd be singing Home on the Range because someone wrote it for him. And that's really sort of what I like. I like the idea of, I think we should be able to do that. We should be able to sing something intimate and contemporary, something that reflects the time we live in, and be able to go out and really serve the music that has lasted all the years. He's a big inspiration. I think he was fantastic. And my voice teacher actually was lived in that era, Bill Miller. He was a tenor, lived in Chicago, sang on the Carnation Breakfast Hour, and would also go to, you know, while singing, you know, something like Imagination is Funny, It Makes a Cloudy Day Sunny on the radio, then head over to Orchestra Hall to sing The Creation or something along those lines. So maybe is part of how I was taught as well.
The inquiring minds want to know question for the day is, how was your experience singing on Good Morning America?
Oh, that was fun. Yeah, I had a good time. I got to sing on Good Morning America and recently the CBS morning show. And it's what most people don't realize is that it's a really small room. Everything looks so much bigger when you're on television, right? But it's, you know, they're... The one thing they have in common, and I love this about my particular business, is that the guys who work backstage are all the same guys. Whether it's at the Met or it's at Good Morning America or it's at CBS, they're all the same guys. And that, you know, that seam that runs through it is nice because you always have something to hold on to. The weirdest part about Good Morning America is that I had to sort of sing karaoke style because they didn't have enough room for a band, so... They took the voice out of the track that I did on the disc, and I had to sing to that. I know, that was really weird.
That's amazing.
But that was weird. That was kind of hard to do. But that on CBS, though, we had a band together, and that was great.
And then you had to go outdoors and schmooze with Diane and Robin and all of that. So that was that
it
pleasant?
It was great. You know, I got to talk about... You know, they were talking about how it was sort of unusual that I would sing some of these more contemporary sounding, you know, they call it pop or crossover. I always say it's not crossover. I've almost stopped trying to fight it because crossover I always think of as things you shouldn't sing that you do. You know, this is sort of luxury crossover, meaning it's accessible music that's beautiful. But anyway, so I was talking to them about that, and I was able to say, you know, well, you know, I'll be at the Met doing this, and one of the men that wrote the songs on here actually wrote the libretto for an opera, so it's not that distant. Come on, people, come to the theater, you know, and if you enjoy this, you'll certainly enjoy, you know, a live performance.
Thank you so much, Nathan.
Oh, you're welcome.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.